Welcome inside Studio 2 in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today on the show, I would say the big topic is politics.
It is indeed.
Yeah, we're going to start off our bigger discussions with our newsmaker segment focused on the Hunter Biden trial. Today, Avi, marks day 3 of that federal trial that's taking place down in Wilmington, Delaware. Hunter Biden is accused of lying about his previous drug addiction when he bought a gun several years ago. We have a Temple law professor on the show, Craig Green, who will break it all down for us, the politics, what to expect in this case. And our middle segment, Avi, will take the bridge over to New Jersey. The Garden State held its primary election Tuesday, so we'll dig into the results with Benjamin Dworkin from the Rowan Institute for Public Policy and Citizenship. So big night in New Jersey last night.
A big night. And if you want to talk to us about it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. We'll end the program today with a segment about sunscreen.
Wait. Do you have on sunscreen today?
Why you got to call me out?
I had to ask. But it's okay because we're talking sunscreen 101.
I don't have on sunscreen today. Sorry, Mom. but I'm going to learn about why that was a mistake.
And correct your ways.
I'm going to change my ways. I'm also going to change the topic now and start digging into our news headlines. So yesterday on the show, we dug into all of the controversy and all of the unanswered questions around the closure of the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. That school is going to close on Friday. And in the 24 hours since that conversation, a ton has happened. So let's get you up to speed. At the end of the show yesterday, we mentioned the breaking news that UArts president Kerry Walk has resigned. So that happened. We also learned earlier today about a class action lawsuit filed by a group of professors and administrators from the school. This lawsuit has to do with securing pay that these people would have been owed if the school had stayed open. So that lawsuit is now on the table. And then yesterday, a very interesting and hopeful tidbit. The Temple University Board of Trustees Chair Mitchell Morgan told the Inquirer that they're having conversations at Temple about some sort of merger with or absorption of the University of the Arts. Morgan said that they've reached out to Governor Josh Shapiro and Mayor Sherelle Parker to talk about the possibilities here. So maybe even a lifeline at the end of all of this. I mean, Cherry, what do you make?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I got a couple of text messages from some lawmakers yesterday. Some folks had heard our segment and said, hey, I just want you to know we're working on this. I won't say who, but a lot of folks are stepping up. They don't want to see this 154-year-old institution go down like that with this sudden closure. A lot of folks are really upset that the president of the University of Arts, U of Arts, has resigned. Mm-hmm. All of this has happened. So, folks, this is a chance to show some leadership. This is a chance to be saviors for these young people who had their careers, you know, trying to build into a career at the U of Arts and have all this sprung on them at the last minute. And so we shall see what happens. But, you know, I'm feeling hopeful that there will be some type of resolution that at least some part of the university or at least these students will have a smoother transition than what was originally presented to them.
But time is of the essence.
Yes.
And because of the nature of this closure, the suddenness of it, there's very little time.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about a merger. The students are already making plans for next year, and they're not planning to be at the University of the Arts, understandably. So there's a lot to be worked out here. The one thing I will mention is that because Temple is a semi-public institution, or at least receives state money, Temple entering the equation also means potentially state money can enter the equation, and it is budget season in Harrisburg. And oh, by the way, the state has a budget surplus right now.
Yeah.
So maybe some ingredients are there for something to happen. But time is really running out.
Yeah, and we'll be keeping an eye on that. And thanks to everybody who reached out, like folks are emailing and just talking about this.
We
hear you. Moving on now, 4 years after the pandemic pause on paying for stuff, that was really nice. We got a lot of free things. Well, get ready to open up your wallet. Because slowly starting to change. Yes. And one example
is SEPTA. Got to find my wallet first. Yeah.
SEPTA is now planning to end the free parking at regional rail lots. Womp womp, y'all. If you recall, SEPTA got rid of the daily rates.
That is becoming your signature sound, by the way. I'm just earmarking that.
Yes. SEPTA got rid of the daily rates entirely to entice people to take regional rail when ridership took a massive hit during the pandemic. And, you know, the regional rail is pretty popular for people commuting to downtown jobs, but everything changed thanks to work from home policies. And so SEPTA's financial cliff right now, it's looming. The agency has an operating budget of over $1.7 billion. It's pandemic. Federal funding will run out at the end of this fiscal year, which is June 30th, literally days away.
25 days.
Ridership is not recovered. They're only at 65% of the ridership that they had pre-pandemic. So they need to find more avenues of making money. And you know what? They're not alone, because in New Jersey, you know, they're going to resume charging for entrance to state parks.
Mm.
They had made it free during the pandemic. As long as you showed that you had gotten vaccinated from COVID-19, you could come to the parks free. But they are trying to generate some new revenue as well.
Yeah, the pay holiday is over.
You were enjoying it, weren't you?
Well, how could I not? Well, not, I mean, I don't park at SEPTA a lot, so I guess I wasn't enjoying it in that case. But so that makes sense, though, right? Because as you mentioned with SEPTA, with the federal funding running out, that money needs to be replaced. So some of that fee relief probably needs to end as well. So, you know, the timing here does make sense. If you're at a state park, maybe you crack open a cold beverage, not alcoholic, because I assume that that's illegal at a state park, but maybe a soda. And the chances are, when you crack open that soda, it's a Coca-Cola, because that is the most popular beverage in America by far.
Yeah, yeah.
But the second most popular is not Pepsi anymore. According to Beverage Digest, it's Dr. Pepper.
Boop, boop. I'm happy about that one.
There goes your sound again. You are happy. You're a big Dr. Pepper fan.
I am. I am. Me too. Dr. Pepper. It's delicious.
23 flavors, each one of them better than the last. I mean, it's a great beverage. I love Dr. Pepper. No, I do like Dr. Pepper.
23 flavors. It's funny how you said this. Go ahead.
Do you know why they call it Dr. Pepper?
Tell me.
The guy who invented it had an accountant named Salt who he hated. And so he said, I'm going to name my beverage the opposite. So instead of accountant Salt, it's Dr. Pepper.
Interesting.
I made that up. I have no
idea. I would say, because I could have sworn that no one really knew if there's a real Dr. Pepper.
The origin story is unknown. No one knows why it's called Dr. Pepper. And if you ever notice, there is no period after the R.
I noticed that.
It's really Dr. Pepper. They got rid of the
Dr. Pepper. By the way, there is a Dr. Pepper museum in Waco, Texas. Who knew?
Nice. You could go to Baylor University, go watch a football game, and then check out the Dr. Pepper Museum.
I love that little... I never noticed that there was no period behind the doctor and Dr. Pepper.
Maybe that's the reason for its rise.
Yeah.
America's second most popular soda.
Yeah, and speaking about rises...
Ah.
One of the things, Avi and I, we have talked about this, is we would love to see a WNBA team come to Philadelphia. And some folks in Rittenhouse, well, guess what? They are drumming up support for this bid to secure a WNBA team in this city. And they're doing it by holding a monthly WNBA game watch party. This is a story that was done by Bea Foreman at The Inquirer, and she profiles a Philadelphia firefighter who's been hosting these watch parties since the spring at Stir Lounge. Her name is Jen Leary, and she says, hey, you know, I was trying to watch games, but no one had the WNBA games on the television at local bars.
Mm.
And if they did, the men's games were drowning out the women's games.
Oh.
So she decided to put one on once a month at Stir Lounge, and about over 100 people showed up.
Nice.
So, folk, there is interest. And, you know, the WNBA is having two new expansion teams by 2026 and two more by 2028. And Philly still has a chance to be part of the 2028 group if we lobby hard enough. That's what I'm saying.
And
I don't know.
If we go to enough bars and watch enough games.
Hey, look, every little
couldn't
bit
hurt.
Helps.
It couldn't hurt.
Every little bit helps.
Have you been watching this season?
I have.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
And I'm going to my very first WNBA game in years next Friday. So
have
really
you seen
excited.
Some of this Caitlin Clark discourse?
Yes.
Online?
Yes.
We probably shouldn't touch that today.
No, not today.
Oh, my God.
But it's a lot.
It is a lot. That's another reflection of its popularity,
mm-hmm.
just the amount people are talking about it.
All these new fans.
All the time, every day.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's not always positive comments, but hey, that's what fandom is.
That's what fandom is. Everyone has something to say.
Let's transition now to our newsmaker interview. It is the third day of the Hunter Biden trial in Wilmington, Delaware. Biden is facing 3 federal felony charges for allegedly lying about his previous drug addiction when purchasing a gun. This is a weapon that he had in his possession for 11 days.
Yesterday's testimony included excerpts from Hunter Biden's audiobook with him narrating graphic passages of his struggles with crack cocaine addiction. To get a better handle on the case, the prosecutor, the defense arguments, how the issue of addiction is playing out, and the role of politics is Temple University law professor Craig Green, who worked at, or should I say, in the Department of Justice. Craig, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And thanks for being here, Craig. So we mentioned that all of this stems from the purchase of a single handgun in October 2018. Hunter Biden did not own this gun for very long. So what did he do that was allegedly illegal? Get folks caught up to speed who maybe have not been following the trial so far.
Sure. I mean, there were 2 big allegations. One of them is the one you mentioned, that everybody who buys a gun has to sign a form, a lot of information on it. One of the things is, are you an user or addicted to drugs? And he said no, and the answer was yes. And the other thing he did was he then possessed a gun for 11 days. It was all he had, the gun. And then his girlfriend at the time found the gun in his truck, went to a grocery store, threw it in the trash, and then it got discovered there by someone searching for recycling. You almost can't make these facts up.
Mm-hmm.
But that having of the gun was also illegal. And so he's facing a maximum of 25 years on the lying about whether he was an addict or a user. And then the possession of the gun.
And so, Craig, what are Hunter Biden's defense arguments in response to those allegations?
Yeah, it's not really clear yet, even from the opening arguments. One of the arguments was, well, he had just gone through treatment, so maybe he wasn't a user. At that moment, he wasn't a user. And that's where the trial has got some very ugly moments where they have him audiobooking his own memoir talking about extraordinary drug use during this time. And they're going to bring on his former wife and 2 of his former girlfriends who talk about his drug use during that time. All that information just to show that he was, in fact, a user when he said he was not. So I think that the facts that are not really very helpful. And of course, he did possess the gun. So, you know, I think the defenses are not very clear right now. On the other hand, it's a pretty sympathetic case. I mean, he had it for 11 days. Didn't do anything with it. He didn't load the gun. His lawyer says he had it in a lockbox, so that's not clear. And no one ever gets prosecuted for these sorts of things unless there's some other crime. Like, as a practical matter in the world, this is not something somebody gets prosecuted, goes to jail for, unless your name's Hunter Biden. And so this is where that selective prosecution came in. He was like, that's the only thing you're going after me for is politics. It's not about the law, but there are the laws on the books. The facts meet the law. The people who make the decisions are the jurors in the end. They'll be the ones who decide whether to return a guilty verdict. But I have to say, the defense is not clear right now. It's not clear what the defense attorneys are really going to push.
Which begs the question, why wasn't there a plea deal? And at one point, if people recall, it did seem like there was a plea deal in place. Remind folks what happened. I know it's a somewhat convoluted story, but the best you can do to summarize it.
Yeah, it was. It was so close. You really get the feeling from the reporting that, like, they were just minutes away from making a deal. And then a couple things happened. There were these IRS whistleblowers who got interviewed in Congress. And the deal, the plea agreement that the prosecutor and Hunter Biden had agreed to, all of a sudden became a hot button lightning rod issue in politics. And next thing you know, Congress is interviewing the tax folks in front of the cameras. And Republicans are going to talk about a sweetheart deal. And then the next thing you know, they're in front of a judge, and a very aggressive prosecutor, Leo Weiss, is brought into the case. And they basically disagree about very small technical things, and the judge refuses to approve it, and both sides refuse to budge. And the next thing you know, there's an indictment, there's a not guilty plea, and they're going to trial. So I think that's all the details are not quite out. Some of the things are still confidential and they're still being held behind closed doors. But you really have the sense that somewhere between June and August of last year, things went from being totally copacetic and resolved to where we are today, which is absolutely a trial in open court with, as I say, again, a real likelihood of not for 25 years, probably, but a real likelihood that Hunter Biden could go to jail for this.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, Craig, about another trial. Former President Donald Trump just had a guilty verdict in New York state court over those falsified records allegations. Are there similarities between what Hunter Biden is going through in this case and what former President Donald Trump went through?
It's like the zaniest week for the legal system and politics. The Democrats were eager for Trump's conviction last Thursday. They got it. And the Republicans were eager for Hunter's trial. And this week it starts up. You know, the similarity is that both of those cases, both the fraud case concerning Stormy Daniels and this, misrepresentation on a gun form and possession for 11 days, these are things that a lot of people are not getting prosecuted for. And so there is this argument in both cases about selective prosecution. There's an argument that the personalities matter. Another thing that's it's not quite a similarity, but another real point of intersection these two cases is in the Trump case, Trump argues basically that not only does Joe Biden and the Democrats, they control the DOJ, they control all criminal justice everywhere in the country, including New York City. And I have to say that nowhere has Biden looked more legally restrained than watching his son go through a federal trial. You know, he could pardon Hunter Biden lawfully today, tomorrow, any day. And yet, out of some sense of legal propriety, he's not interfering with that case. I mean, and like I said, the likelihood of this case is there may well be a guilty verdict, and a president's son may go to jail when the president could have intervened and used pardon power to get him out of it. So I think there are a couple of different overlaps. It's really an eerie intersection just time-wise, one week to the next.
Let me ask you, as someone who worked in the Department of Justice, this last couple of weeks, has it damaged the image of prosecutors? Do you think there's going to be greater skepticism moving forward of the profession in general, or do you think this is just a blip?
Yeah, I think it's time will tell, but it's certainly not a blip. I mean, there have been attacks on legal institutions for a long while now, and I think these two cases, in a weird way, it's all the Rorschach test. You sort of see what you want to see. But you could look at this and say these are extraordinary people who are going through ordinary criminal procedures. They got grand jury indictment. They got prosecutors coming after them. They feel singled out. Everybody feels singled out.
Yeah.
And they're going through the ordinary process of getting guilty convictions if that's what happened. But, of course, there are people who just think this is all corrupt and weaponized. And I have to say that it's not that easy to see when you look at the real details of the facts.
Wow. And so we've done the jury selection. We've had opening arguments. How long is this trial, Craig, expected to last? And what can we expect going forward?
Well, I think it's going to be real short, probably, because a lot of the facts are very cut and dry. This is in contrast to the Trump trial. And then I think this is another similarity. You know, I don't think anybody should be thinking there's going to be an acquittal in the Hunter Biden case. But what there might be is there might be a hung jury. There might be some juror who has enough sympathy or empathy. Of course, some of these jurors we already know have experiences, a lot of people do, with drug addiction in their lives and the kinds of things that people do under circumstances of drug addiction. It might be that in the end, some juror just can't quite find their way find Hunter Biden guilty. But, you know, I think in terms of timing, I think this is something that'll last certainly not a month, maybe even just a few days. I think that's what we should look at. I think, again, Hunter Biden will not testify, as Trump didn't testify. So you'll be left with these questions of, is there reasonable doubt? And I think in both cases, from an analytical point of view, it's not that easy to see. But, you know, juries aren't all analytical. It's not all rational in the jury room.
It is a human endeavor, of course. And we thank you, Craig Green, for joining us. That is Craig Green, professor at Temple University's Klein School of Law. He used to work in the Department of Justice and clerked for Merrick Garland. Craig Green, thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
And coming up, we'll dig into the New Jersey primary election results. Stick with us. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way, Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back, voters, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Yesterday, New Jersey primary voters, they went to the polls. One of the biggest races was for Senator Bob Menendez's seat. He is on trial on federal bribery charges. Andy Kim easily beat his two Democratic challengers in the primary and will face Cape May Republican Curtis Bashaw this fall. Menendez announced earlier this week that he'll run this fall as an independent.
Oh, boy. So there's a lot to dissect in the results, including the fact that this was the first election for Democrats without the state's controversial county line ballot design. What impact did that have? Joining us to talk about the big takeaways from Tuesday's election and what they tell us about Garden State voters is Benjamin Dworkin, director of the Rowan Institute for Public Policy and Citizenship at Rowan University. Ben, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here with all of you. Thank you.
And of course, New Jersey listeners, or even Pennsylvania and Delaware listeners, how do you feel about the primary results? What are you taking away? And what left you scratching your head? What issues or candidates got you out to the ballot box? And do you think Senator Menendez should stay in the race as an independent? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
So, Ben, we want to start the conversation off by looking at the results from last night's primary and then give your big takeaways.
Okay, so this was a fascinating race because it was effectively, you have a primary for the Republicans, you have a primary for the Democrats, and they ran in very different fields of battle. Mm. The line, as you referred to, the county line, there are 21 counties in New Jersey. Each county party organization, so the county Democrats and county X and the county Republicans in the same county, they have their own rules for making endorsements. Who are we going to endorse? It's Hillary versus Barack Obama. Which one are we going to support? And what has happened for decades until this year is that the Democrats were allowed to put all of those endorsed candidates in one column. Mm-hmm. And this allowed you to see, okay, we endorsed Hillary, as most of New Jersey did back in 2008. And therefore, it was Hillary and was all the people who were running for everything down to sheriff and to town council. All in one column. This had the effect, said people who didn't like it, of putting your thumb on the scale.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It kind of said, hey, these are the people we like, which was exactly what it was designed to do.
Pretty
but if you were challenging that, then you were thrown into a different column, column B.
Ballot Siberia, they called it.
Sometimes Ballot Siberia. Sometimes you were right there next to them. You know, it wasn't always that. But yes, in the egregious cases, that's where you ended up. Andy Kim was running, and the First Lady of New Jersey was Tammy Murphy had also entered. And Tammy Murphy, when she was in this race for Bob Menendez's seat, did what most people in the last several decades have been doing in New Jersey. That is, you curry the support of all these
different organizations
to get that.
Made it a lot easier.
And Andy Kim went out and sued, and because he was looking for immediate relief, the federal judge agreed with him, said, yes, the line, as we call it, this preferred ballot position in the primary is unconstitutional. Democrats cannot have it.
However,
the Republicans did sue.
Yeah.
And therefore, the Republicans ran with lines.
Right.
And so the results yesterday.
It's like almost a perfect, it's like a scientific experiment set up in the real world.
Yeah. You know, for political scientists like me, this is fascinating stuff. So the results yesterday, one of the big takeaways is that the line mattered for the Republicans, where it still existed. Mm. And Curtis Bashaw, who won, had a majority of the lines, in big Republican counties where a lot of the primary vote will be generated. And it clearly made a difference. Now, he also outspent his next challenger, Mayor of Mendham Borough, Christina Serrano-Glasner. He outspent her by 5-1.
Yeah.
So that also makes a difference. But the line clearly had an impact because she tended to win the lines, the places where she had the line, and he won where he had the line. You should think of it this way. If you're a Republican and you're voting, Donald Trump is at the top. Who is going to be the person running for U.S. Senate? If you have the line, then
you're right next to
him. You're right underneath him.
Yeah.
And so even though Trump endorsed
the person who lost in many ballots, the person that won, Bashaw, was right underneath, in the
same column as Trump.
And so he'll be the GOP nominee for U.S. Senate now.
And Andy Kim will be the nominee, though there was no line. He did have a few challengers. And so what we saw, the big takeaway for the Democrats, getting back to your original question, I'm sorry, but the big one of the big takeaways was that organization matters. Mm-hmm. Party organizations still have the lists, have the people, have the discipline to go out and knock on doors and get, hey, we need you to come out to vote, and here's who we want you to vote for. It's not as easy to find these names on a ballot. Because you're going to have to look through if there's four or five people running for that position. But it it clearly made a difference. And in almost all the big contested cases that we were looking at in yesterday's New Jersey Democratic primary, it was the organization that pulled it out.
Mm. Wow. Wow.
Okay. So Andy Kim looks like, we know, will be the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate. We've got Curtis Bashaw on the GOP side. For folks that don't know him, he's an entrepreneur from Cape May. And then we have Bob Menendez, who will maybe, we think, be running as an independent. He is the incumbent, the longtime incumbent, as many of our listeners know. He is going through his own federal trial right now up in Manhattan. What do you think his impact will be on the general if he stays in the race, if any?
Negligible. Yeah.
Even with all of that name recognition.
Yes, but it's... Right now, he's got a very negative brand. It's not good name recognition. First of all, we live in a hyper-partisan time. People look for parties. They're not looking for independents in terms of independent candidates. Mm. So you take that. People are ready to vote Trump and all the Republicans or Biden and all the Democrats. Yeah. Second of all... right now, Bob Menendez has about an 8% approval rating. I mean, when you're that low, it's really just staff and your family who likes you. That is, you know, it's just a minimal amount of people who are there. So he doesn't have a path to victory. He has a potential to be a spoiler, but I don't think that will really happen.
We'll explain that part because 8%, I mean, that's not
him.
Nothing.
Yeah.
No, I don't think he'll get 8%, but let's say... He would take votes presumably from a Democrat, and therefore he would hurt somebody like Andy Kim, who is running. However, Andy Kim, I mean, New Jersey, put it this way, New Jersey is a very Democratic state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are nearly 1 million more registered Democrats than registered Republicans. Now, in an off election year, it's not a presidential year, not everybody shows up to vote. You'll have 45-50% in a gubernatorial year. This year, because it's the presidency, we're looking at 70-75% voter turnout. When you have that kind of numerical advantage and that many people show up, all these Democrats start coming out. And so we are fully expecting at this point, obviously things can change, but at this point, Joe Biden's going to probably win from 12 to 16 points. Over, and that's why it's going to be a solidly blue state when you look at any of these color-coded maps. And Andy Kim is going to ride part of that. And so even if he loses 8 points that get taken away by Bob Menendez, which is a stretch he's still winning by 8 points. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, no, I think this is really about leverage. Bob Menendez, when he is a candidate, has leverage to negotiate with party leaders, with prosecutors, with people who have to raise money that he ends up having to use for his legal defense. It gives him relevancy at a moment when he needs it. And so I'm not sure it's really anything beyond that.
Interesting.
And I think we have a caller on the line to talk about this issue. We have Chris. Chris, you are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is because Bob Menendez, who I personally know, was a good senator, he did not bother to stay on the ballot. And because he did not stay in the Democratic primary, I couldn't vote for him. Therefore, my loyalty to him is gone. I'm going with Andy Kim, of course.
Interesting. So interesting, that's Chris's take. Perspective, and it speaks to what you just said,
yeah.
Ben.
Yeah. Very, very interesting take. And your reaction or response to what Chris said.
I think it's right. Look, things have been very tough. First of all, we should understand Bob Menendez, as a senator, had a tremendous record. He was very accomplished. He was head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. He was a big thinker about international affairs. He was a big advocate and a successful effective advocate for New Jersey and New Jersey's interests. That having been said, he's obviously been caught up in a number of these kinds of legal proceedings and these corruption allegations. So it's a difficult thing. There are people who did like him, but this was enough. Everybody, 6 years ago, he ran into trouble and the federal prosecutors tried to put him in jail and they end up with a hung jury. He won re-election in 2018 big time. But, everyone pretty much abandoned him once a new round of allegations came out.
And let's switch gears a little bit. Can we move to New Jersey's third congressional district race? And that was Andy Kim's seat. We had Herb Conaway. That's the victor on the Democratic side over two rivals. What's the makeup of the district out there and your take on the outcome there?
Yeah. So the third congressional district where Andy Kim left his seat in order to run for the Senate had become, since redistricting a couple years ago, a very Democratic district. This is what we call a plus 14 Biden district. Biden wins those towns by 14 points. So this is going to be pretty much a safe seat. This has brought out a lot of competition for people who wanted to therefore get into Congress. You had two major candidates here, Herb Conaway, longtime state assemblyman, and his partner in the same legislative district, Assemblywoman Carol Murphy. They're both very talented politicians. He's been around much longer. She's only been around a few years. So what you were looking at here, the difference on issues was negligible. No one could really find anything. These people practically voted the same way. But a couple things led to Herb Conaway's significant, it wasn't close.
Yeah, 49-25, I believe.
Yeah, big victory. So this wasn't particularly close. So first of all, he had the organizational support. Had the Democrats kept the lines, he would have had the line, Herb Conaway would have had the lines in all three counties that make up the district, and we wouldn't even be talking about it whether it was competitive. Mm. But there wasn't a line, so now everybody has thinks they have a better shot at doing this. He had still the organizational support. He had more money, significantly, including outside money, Vote Vets. He's a veteran. He's a doctor. He's a lawyer. He was able to generate some outside folks who came in with mailings and things like that on his behalf. He's been around longer, which means he's had a lot more time to just do favors for people.
And build up.
And just say, oh, I helped your kid when they were doing something or you needed some help with the state agency. He's just had more years to build up that kind of goodwill. And so all of that are significant. What was really at stake here, because there was very little issue difference between the two top candidates, was that Carol Murphy would have been the first woman to represent this district. Herb Conaway is an African American. He will be the first African American to represent this district. So In that sense, either would have been significant, but for the reasons I just listed, Herb Conaway really took this race and ran away with it.
Let's see if there are any breadcrumbs in yesterday's results that tell us about what might happen in November. Mm. there was no one running against Trump. You could pretty much only vote for Trump. I'm not sure what we make of that. There was an uncommitted possibility on the Democratic side. I think it's at about 9%, 8-9% right now. Biden getting 88-89% of the Democratic vote. What do you take away from all of that?
At least in New Jersey, the uncommitted vote, which really has to do with the war in Gaza, mm-hmm. And that's what generated it, does not have a growing support.
It was higher in some Midwest states, I believe.
Yeah, and so it wasn't here. You had up in the northern part of the state, in the Patterson area, Congressman Bill Pascrell, who's 80.
A long time incumbent,
but he was being challenged. That district has more Muslim Americans than almost any other district in the entire country, yeah. Certainly in the state. And he was being challenged specifically on the Gaza issue by a local mayor. And still, Bill Pascrell won with 80% of the vote.
Yeah, that one is not particularly close.
So I think what that tells us is, For Democrats who are worried about this tension, it's obviously a tension. You're going to hear about it, and it's and very unfortunate for those who are trying to build party unity. But it is the nature of things that we have to go through this fight, that Democrats have to go through this fight. But at least in New Jersey, I think one of the things is that the results are this isn't something that's really going to divide. Biden is winning handily. And even someone like Bill Pascrell, where the issue was front and center in his primary race, he won handily.
Got to ask you, looking ahead, the governor's race in New Jersey, some folks have already declared that they're running.
It is
your thoughts on that? And
wild.
We only have about 90 seconds, so tell us your thoughts on that.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. It is New Jersey's governor constitutionally is the most powerful governorship in the entire country. In New Jersey politics, therefore, this is the big enchilada. Everybody wants this. You are the only statewide elected official. You appoint everybody to everything. It's a hugely powerful position. So it's an open seat because incumbent Phil Murphy is done finishing his second term. And you have some of the best talent on the Democratic side doing this dance. Some have already declared, mm-hmm. and some are just waiting. But without a line, where these are folks are just listed like in a school board election, where they're just drawing out the name and who bits one position, they're just one on top of the other. That really is going to be interesting to see how organizations that's going to be a high turnout primary election. It's going to be fascinating. And
who are the big names to watch there?
Five of them, really. Former State Senator Steve Sweeney, who's mm-hmm. from South Jersey.
Democrat.
Yeah.
These are all the Democrats on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. You have, Newark Mayor Roz Baraka, Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop, and two members of Congress, Josh Gottheimer and Mikey Sherrill, who are all... Potentially, you could have the former head of the NJ Education Association, the teachers union, as people call it, Sean Spiller, might be getting in. That split, you can win a primary with 22% of the vote.
Sounds like Philly's mayor's race, but projected out over a whole state.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's where we are.
Wow.
And by the way, I'm impressed. Didn't even need a note. Knew everybody's name off the top. I love it. Oh, absolutely.
Ben lives and breathes this stuff.
They've all come to Rowan University to speak.
That's Ben Dworkin, director of the Rowan Institute for Public Policy and Citizenship. Thanks for the time, Ben.
Thank you.
Got more in Studio 2, talking sunscreen, coming up.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. Funded by the Knight Foundation, the Chamber announces its Leading the Way Cell and Gene Therapy in Greater Philadelphia report. More at chmbr.biz/CGTPHL.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. It's getting hotter, folks. Of course, you got to drink water, stay hydrated. But also, apparently, you got to wear sunscreen.
Yes, you do, Avi. I know I try to wear sunscreen mm-hmm. on a daily basis. I don't know. Did you see this, Avi? Just recently, I read that sunscreen made in the U.S. has notably poorer protection from harmful UVA rays than other products worldwide. Did you know that?
I thought USA was number one.
I thought we were too, but apparently not. But here to help us out with everything sunscreen is a friend of the show, Dr. Christina Lee Chung, a dermatologist at Schweiger Dermatology Group here in Philadelphia. Christina, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
It's great to have you back. And if you folks have any sunscreen-related questions, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And here's a comment from Cassandra, who says, my dermatologist and my facial esthetician said that our skin really needs sunscreen and sunblock to stay healthy and protected. So, doctor, what is the role of sunscreen in skin health and overall health?
So, obviously, it protects you from skin cancer, right, which is why probably the single most important reason to wear sunscreen daily. That's actually a very good question, because it does play a role in skin health. So any amount of sun damages your skin, right? And what happens there is that very top layer of skin, obviously there are changes underneath too, but that very top layer of skin, the sun ages it. Right. And so, yes, everybody thinks about aging. They don't want to have skin cancer and have something cut off their face. They don't want to look old. They don't want to have wrinkles. But what happens when your skin ages from UV rays is it literally decreases the functioning of your skin. Right. Because the skin is there as a barrier. Yeah. Right. It keeps things out. It keeps homeostasis. Right. Throughout the entire integumentary system. And so as your skin ages and UV rays accelerate skin aging and promote damage. Right. It actually does prevent your skin in the long term from protecting yourself.
Oh, so wow. How does sunscreen or sunblock work exactly?
So there are two types of sunscreens, right? And this, I think this is like all the rage. There's chemical sunscreens and then there are mineral sunscreens. So there are ones, so the chemical sunscreens technically are particles that absorb a certain ray of UV radiation, right? Because the sun's rays are on a spectrum, right? It's like visible light, blue light, things like that, and UV rays and things like this. So those chemical sunscreens actually take the certain specific ray, like UV ray of sunlight, right? The radiation light, and they actually absorb it before it gets to your skin. Okay. Mineral sunscreens or blocking agents like titanium and zinc, they literally create a film, right? That is literally physically is there present between the rays and your skin. So it's almost like building an invisible wall.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
So is one of those better than the other?
You know, that is actually a hugely debated, controversial topic in sunscreen. And the question always arises, like, what is the best sunscreen? And I guarantee you that almost every single dermatologist on this planet will tell you that what the best sunscreen is the sunscreen that you will use, whether it's mineral or chemical. Certainly, there are pros and cons to both. Certainly, there's the entire environmental part of sunscreen.
Now, what happens after it leaves your skin?
Right. So that's always an issue. However, I will say that people of color are not immune to the sun's rays, right? You get skin cancer at lower rates, but you still get skin cancer and you still age and your skin still suffers the damage of UV radiation. And the issue is, honestly, I've worked in Philadelphia my whole life, born, raised, I'm a person of color myself. It is very difficult for a person of color who has even a medium toned skin to find a purely chemical sunscreen that goes on well. There have been amazing advances in technology, right? So could we get like a Fitzpatrick 3 or 4 like tinted sunscreen that's purely mineral that we could do it. But you get to like the really darkly pigmented people, we call them Fitzpatrick type 5 and 6, right? You get to that end of skin color and it's really a challenge. And so
and
for
it's
them,
like a it's film, you can see it.
Right, and you can always see it. So that is a very loaded question. What is the best sunscreen to use? Because if you talk about things like cosmesis or the environment and things like that, you're really going to end up like not protecting an entire population. Wow. Of people.
I want to bring in this question from Pam, and I'll tell you, I usually put sunblock on my face, but not on my body. And Pam asks, has the research changed significantly in the last couple of decades? Before, it used to be important to wear sunscreen when you go to the beach. Now it's like you have to wear it when you're inside all day. So what is the rule here? And where, I mean, do you have to do the full body, just the face? What scalp? What are the rules?
So I guess the party line is you should wear sunscreen everywhere all the time. However, I think the best way to conceptualize that for like the lay person is if your skin is changing color in the sun, right, whether it turns pink or it turns like a little bit tan. The minute it changes color in the sun, you're suffering. Your skin cells are suffering UV damage.
Let's bring in a caller.
So the tan is damage. Okay.
Let's bring a caller now.
Sorry to burst your bubble, Sherry.
So we alluded to the possibility, while dreams are being shattered over here, we alluded to this idea that there's a difference between American sunscreen and what you can buy abroad. And we have a caller on the line who has either a question or a comment about that. Nancy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Oh, well, I just wanted to get an understanding of why we are not able to purchase sunscreens that are made, for example, in Europe or in Asia, where we keep hearing that those particular sunscreens are so much more effective and safe. And so wanted to really understand why we're not permitted to purchase them here.
The FDA hasn't approved those ingredients.
Is there more to it? Why does it seem like the rules, I guess, are more flexible in Europe as opposed to America?
It's purely pharmaceutical regulation.
And that's why. Mm-hmm. Are they better?
I think most dermatologists would say yes, that some of the chemical sunscreens and the products that are available abroad may do a better job. I know that the Academy of Dermatology, there's a lot of lobbying and there's a lot of support for compelling the FDA to bring some of these ingredients and these sunscreen products to market in the U.S.
I'll be honest. I just hate the way sunscreen feels in my body. It's goopy. It's greasy. I just cannot imagine starting every day by putting this stuff on. What's your suggestion for me? Just get over it, or do I have some options here?
I do like to say get over it to a lot of things in life.
However, suck it up, Bobby.
Yes, so a part of it is suck it up, but honestly, sun protection really is not just one thing, right? And that's what I think, that's a common misperception, that sun protection is you have to wear sunscreen all the time. It's the only thing that protects you, and that's actually not true, right? I would actually, this might be controversial, but I personally think that covering up is actually better than any sunscreen. And the reason I say that is because I always tell people, look at the skin on your butt, whether you're 10, 20,
it's smooth.
40, you see how the color is totally different. Mm-hmm. And by the time you're like 30, it just looks different. By the time you're 40 and 50, you're like, why does it have any wrinkles or sunspots or anything? It's because it's covered.
Yeah.
Right. So I personally, my mantra is I get people hate wearing sunscreen. And so for those people, I just think you have to double down and cover up. Right. It stinks. But you know what? You get more evaporative. Is it depending on like the textile that you're wearing? Right. Like sometimes covering yourself in the sun and putting a physical barrier like clothing between you and your skin actually keeps you cooler. So that's why linen is very common. You know, it doesn't do great. Like what you want to do is you want to hold whatever it is you're wearing up like to the sun and see if light comes through it. And kind of, you know, obviously linen, tons of sun comes through. So it's less protective than like a polyester shirt, right? So, and then just avoiding sun at the highest UV peak hours between the hours of 10 and 2. I go to the beach. I go to the pool. I'm that crazy person that isn't out there until like 4 or 5 o'clock at night or in the afternoon, you know, because the UV index is significantly lower. You know, and then there are kind of supplements and things like that that you can take that help you, that could help protect you from the sun as well. So sunscreen isn't, it is by far something that you should wear. And if you can suck it up and do it, it is going to add a significant, there will be a significant increase in your ability to protect yourself if you can tolerate it.
I have this question from Mary. Is there a sunscreen that's more helpful for people with diabetes? And I would add to that other medical issues.
So people with medical issues or conditions that make them sensitive to the sun, whether you're on a medication that sensitizes you to the sun, or you have an underlying disease process or condition that sensitizes you to the sun, it really isn't a matter of what product or what brand or what trade. It's really a matter of, are you reapplying it? Right. Mm-hmm. Because no matter what, no sunscreen you apply is going to last more than 2 hours on a good day. Right. But if you're in the water or sweating, it's generally gone, you know, in an hour or so. So it's more about reapplying than it is about what exact product you've chosen.
Got to ask you, we have about a minute or so left, but if you don't listen, you get a sunburn. Mm-hmm. How do you treat it most effectively without causing even more damage to your skin?
Yeah, sunburn's really tough. You know, my daughter got a really nasty one this spring break. And she's half Asian. So it is. It's really painful. I mean, it's essentially like getting a burn. It's like if you put your hand on a stove and you put it on a hot pot and you burned it, right? So really, it's about protecting the barrier, keep it moisturized, Vaseline and things like that after the heat is gone is good. But cooling it down. You don't want to put ice on it, but maybe in a cool bath will help, right? Ibuprofen will help inflammation. So in the beginning, it really is trying to stop that inflammation, right? So ibuprofen, cool it down and like in cold water, things like that. After the pain is gone and the acute inflammation is gone, you just want to protect the barrier. So eventually you'll peel and all this stuff, but you want to make sure your skin is moisturized and hydrated. If you get blisters and they peel and you have raw skin, you want to make sure you keep it covered and prevent infection.
Real quick, mm-hmm. What SPF do I need?
Oh, yeah.
So it used to be 15, but Caucasians, it's recommended that Caucasian folks wear a sunscreen SPF 30 every day.
30 or above.
30 or above, right? And people of color, they say 15. I would say 15 or 30. But again, it's about reapplying.
All good information that we can use this summer, and we will use. Ooh. I'll make a resolution to use more sunscreen after Yay. Hearing all of that. Thank you, Christina.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me again.
That is Dr. Christina Chung, a dermatologist at Schweiger Dermatology Group right here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and a friend of the show.
And a friend
Love
of the
that.
Show.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Studio 2. Our show was produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Kopes. Diana Martinez engineered today's show from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg with some sunscreen on right now.
Covered in cool, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.